calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's starting to come unglued really rapidly in Iraq right now, as we predicted on the program yesterday afternoon. It looks like civil war has broken out. The Sunnis now are saying that they will not participate in the ongoing process of creating a government in Iraq until the Shia perpetrators of the deaths of Sunnis are brought to justice. And the Shia are saying they won't participate until the Sunni bombers of the Golden Temple are brought to... It's turning into a mess. And we're going to get into that in some detail today on our program. We're also going to be talking about port security. It is ongoing curiosity. And is the next generation being killed off by secondhand smoke? We're going to be talking about that in the next hour. And you won't want to miss the RNC's Guide to Committing Treason in our third hour. You'll be shocked by this. But first, are we selling off our national security to the highest bidder? Do we want corporations buying and selling even our personal identity through RFID chips? Jim Harper is the Director of Information Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, their website, cato.org. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks, sir. Thanks for having me on.
I see another URL. Is it privacilla.org, PRIVACILLA.org?
That's here, right.
Is that your personal website?
It's the privacy-only think tank that I've run for several years now and brought it over to Cato when I joined up with the Cato Institute a couple years ago.
Okay. Well, I'm curious what your take in the Cato Institute, being historically a libertarian, some would describe conservative, I think you'd probably describe it more as a libertarian leaning think tank, what your take is on, let's start off with RFID chips.
Sure. RFID chips are radio frequency identification tags. For listeners who don't know, these are tiny chips that have an antenna attached that communicate with a reader. The energy from the reader powers the chip to bounce a signal back. And the capability of this technology, though it's an old technology, everybody knows about radio, and you make your living from it quite well.
Right. These are basically what in the old days would have been called a passive transponder.
Sure, yeah. This is a passive transponder with miniaturization. Now you can use these chips for a variety of things. It's slightly overhyped at times, I think, but some people refer to it as the possibility of there being an Internet of Things, so that possessions and goods and items of all kinds can be tracked. One of the important details about this is that unlike a UPC code, you know, the universal product code that appears on all our groceries, the lines that they scan on the grocery scanners, each chip can have a different code embedded in it, so that each individual item is separately linked.
Right, so this doesn't just say, hi, I'm a box of cornflakes. This says, I am this particular box of cornflakes that was
bought
at 3:22 p.m. at the Kroger at the corner of 2nd and Main on the 16th of July, 2004. Now, here's the question, Jim. We have companies that have aggressively attached, shall we say, their logos to our clothing, to the point where, you know, half of America seems to be walking billboards. It's really weird. I mean, companies that pay for advertising have got us walking around with their advertising on them. What's to keep a company from putting a chip into that little tag that has their logo on it, or some little, you know, some place in the fabric of the clothing, or in the insole of the shoe or something, so that when I buy that shoe, when that transaction is completed at the store, that serial number gets scanned, and that manufacturer then knows that I'm the guy who bought that shoe. They've got my credit card information. With my credit card information, they can buy and sell everything from my medical records to my school records to my employment records, so that now I'm walking around with this RFID chip. I walk into another store. It scans me, and it says, welcome, Mr. Hartman. You would like our such-and-such because of your such-and-such history. Or if I'm standing in a protest group outside of, you know, whatever, say I'm protesting in favor of the Cato Institute, and the government has decided they don't like the Cato Institute, and they drive by and they simply scan that crowd for RFID chips, and they discover that I'm wearing one, and, that's Hartman there. I mean, isn't this a little weird?
Well, you've honed in on some very important concerns about RFID, but I think the starting point is the reason why RFID is going to be used in the first place. Currently, it's mostly used on packing crates and pallets and things like that, so that that companies with big logistics problems can solve those problems. And literally billions and billions of dollars per year are wasted in shipments that are off going off the wrong direction, merchandise that is lost, merchandise that's stolen off the back of trucks and out of warehouses. So the reason for RFID is to solve these logistical problems and to control what they call shrinkage in the retail industry.
Right.
That is stealing. And when these billions, because the retail sector is so competitive, these billions will effectively be passed back to consumers in the form of lower prices. And that's why...
Jim, come on, you're really that naive?
I'm more than that naive. I see it all the time.
You don't think that if a company can make an extra profit that they're going to pass that profit on to their stockholders in the form of an increased dividend rather than passing it along to consumers?
The first company to do it, the company that gets ahead of the other companies, gets to enjoy that profit. But as soon as all the companies catch up and use these same efficiencies, they won't be able to make that profit anymore.
And then we have price competition, like they always have been. And then we have a level playing field, but we've given up all of our privacy.
Well,
so
consumers are better off. So now let's turn to...
Now, why are consumers better off, Jim?
Because they're paying lower prices.
But we're being tracked.
Let's talk about that next, and that is an important issue that we have to deal with. When RFID is used in packing in item at the item level, which is probably coming, but it's not coming as fast as most people think, for the most part, it'll be on packaging. That means when you buy a bag of dog food, there may be an RFID chip in the plies of the paper in the dog food bag. But no important information that matters is going to be conveyed by the chip or used by the chip. That is, you'll take the dog food bag home, you'll fill up Fifi's bowl for a few weeks, and then you'll throw the bag and the chip away.
Hang on just a second here, Jim. Both when I lived in Vermont and now that I live in Oregon, in both cases we've had local supermarkets that have membership things, you know, where you become a member and you get discounts on certain things and like that, and they give us a little barcode which they can scan, and I have discovered that barcode is unique to me.
Yes.
So when I buy something at that grocery store and I give them my barcode, they scan that, they put that into a database, they know what I'm buying, they have my credit card number, they know that I was in the store at that particular time. Now, if they're doing that at that level right now, why wouldn't they also say, add to that database, oh, and by the way, he bought this particular thing with this particular RFID chip? And for that matter, why wouldn't the manufacturer who says, this guy just bought a pack of Marlboros, for example, you know, the manufacturers that are just super fighting for brands, like the tobacco industry, he just bought a pack of Marlboros, so the people who manufacture Salem or whatever, I don't smoke anymore, so I don't remember what the brands are, but, they buy that database of all the people who bought Marlboros from the Kroger chain, for example, and then they go direct to consumer marketing. I mean, they're already doing this stuff, why wouldn't they just ratchet it up a notch and then we've got no privacy left whatsoever.
Well, the fact that you know about it and that you're allowing it to happen means that you're making a conscious choice to take the discount that they're offering you in exchange for that information.
Actually, I don't.
You should be careful about doing. What I do is I give I use the phone numbers of various people, including my family members and past roommates and houses I've lived in. Sometimes I go to a store and I buy, and they think that I'm an Indian woman because of a past roommate who had a phone number that I use. So that's a self-help measure to prevent this data.
So, Jim Harper of the Cato Institute, you're suggesting Cato.org, the website, and Privacilla.org, your website. You're suggesting that we should be complicit in corporations setting up a system and a standard that is going to be so intrusive that we should be lying to them to protect ourselves, like you do?
Well, we should cooperate if we think the benefits are greater than the concerns, and many people do. Other people don't. I guess you and I are the same in that we prefer not to have our purchases tracked.
But don't you think the average consumer is not that sophisticated?
Thanks to you, the average consumer is increasingly sophisticated every day. And everybody, I think, knows now that these cards are used for that purpose. More and more people know. I wouldn't say everybody does, but those cards are used for that purpose. They realize that stores want to know their customers. They want to understand what their customers need. There are dangers that they will be marketed to in ways they don't prefer. But those are risks that consumers are fully capable of accommodating.
So you don't think that there should be any regulation on this? You don't think the government should play any role in this? It should just be, let's leave it up to the corporations. They'll do the right thing. And if they don't, we can always give them a phony phone number.
I think consumerism and a watchdog press are more important than leaving it up to corporations. Corporations are not the ones that should be in control here. It should be consumers.
But the watchdog press is now a corporate press.
Watchdog Press is not a corporate press. You're part of the Watchdog Press, and I challenge you to admit your corporate ties right now.
Well, there's a corporation that owns this network and that owns this. I'm broadcasting to you out of a Clear Channel radio station.
But you speak your mind, don't you?
I do. But I am increasingly convinced that we are the exception, not the rule. But you open a whole other can of worms there with that, Jim. But anyhow, we're out of time. But Jim Harper, the director of information policy studies at the Cato Institute, cato.org. Privacilla.org is website. Jim, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
They want it now. They want to get it and don't care how.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. You know, I say we're helping you win the water cooler wars. It's one of my favorite slogans here. I just taught you what not to do. I got to say, I can't believe I took that bait. You're having a discussion about A, and when it's not going well, what you do is you flip to B, and if the other guy is dumb enough to take the bait and say, oh, we'll talk about B, then, you know, yes, we were talking about RFID chips, not radio station. By the way, the radio industry is incredibly regulated. There's a whole bunch of words that if I were to say them on the air, I would be off the air immediately. But nonetheless, we were talking about RFID chips, and this is interesting. The Center for Democracy and Technology, news release just out. Digital technology makes surveillance easier. Stronger laws are needed, report finds. And, of course, Cato and other organizations like that always would be opposed to any kind of laws. They fundamentally don't believe that we, the people, in a democracy, should be overseeing what the corporate aristocracy is up to. And they suggest, this new report suggests that technology is making government surveillance easier, not harder. Meanwhile, the laws that are supposed to prevent the government from unfairly accessing personal information haven't changed in two decades, says CDT policy director Jim Dempsey, the principal author of the report. So, anyhow, that's my take on that. The situation in Iraq, this is changing by the minute. And changing in some very, very troubling ways right now, the situation in Iraq. And, you know, I think a real significant concern, all of us should have a lot of concern about this, that in Iraq right now, well, this Edward Fong and Robert Worth in the New York Times just an hour or so ago, at least 95 people, some of them prominent Sunni Arab clerics, were killed in revenge in Baghdad and the surrounding areas in the chaotic 24 hours following the bombing Wednesday morning of one of Shiite Islam's holiest shrines in the town of Samarra, an Interior Ministry official said today. More bodies are being discovered as we speak throughout the day across Iraq. Sunni Arab politicians broke off talks with Shiite and Kurdish leaders over the formation of a new government, saying they would not engage in discussions until those responsible for the attacks on the Sunnis had been brought to justice. Now, keep in mind, it was a Shia shrine that was blown up, the golden dome of the Al-Askariya shrine. So here we have the Sunnis saying that they're not going to participate in the political process any longer, period. That's it. No more political process. And the Shia saying, hey, you blew up our shrine. Somebody blew up our shrine. And as I predicted yesterday, you'll recall I read you the story from one of the Russian news services that was talking about how Americans dressed up as Iraqi army, or Iraqi civilians rather, had been arrested by a local Iraqi police force for setting up a car bomb in a Baghdad neighborhood. And then once they were arrested, the whole bunch of GIs came in and Humvees and tanks and things and liberated these two guys from the local police department. And I suggested, A, you know, I there's no evidence for this that I'm able to find other than the fact that it's being reported in the Russian press, which doesn't mean it's true. In fact, I'd very, very skeptical of it. But secondly, and this was my big point, this is going to be reported in the Middle East, along with other types of stories like this. I mean, they're basically going to be saying, and in fact, it turns out they are saying that, oh, this is Americans who did this. I mean, you know, they're going to be looking around for, you know, who did this, right? Who's responsible for this? Who is it who blew up this shrine? And as of this moment, now this may change, you know, from moment to moment, but as of this moment, nobody has specifically taken responsibility for it. And so, you know, the conspiracy-minded folks and oppressed people are always, you know, in any oppressed society, there is rife with conspiracy because you're trying to make sense out of order and you know somebody's out to get you. You're trying to figure out, you know, who is it, what's going on. And certainly a country that is being occupied by a foreign country, conspiracy is going to run wild, conspiracy theories. And in fact, I would suggest that at those times in American history, when Americans have felt the most oppressed, have been the times that there have been the most conspiracy theories and probably, frankly, the most conspiracies. But in any case, now we're hearing, you know, the word coming out about this. Now, on top of that, now we have George W. Bush coming out and speaking to us and saying some, you know, really and truly strange things. Here's one.
More people learn about the transaction that has been scrutinized and approved by my government.
Now, wait a second. What did he just say? Did he just say my government?
My government. The more they'll be comforted that our ports will be secure.
My government? When did we become a government owned by George W. Bush? When did that happen? Did something happen? I wasn't looking. Yeah, we flipped into a royal aristocracy here.
The more people learn about the transaction that has been scrutinized and approved by my government, the more they'll be comforted that our ports will be secure.
Mm-hmm. See, this is the lack of differentiation that's been a hallmark of the Bush administration, is the failure to separate in people's minds, and obviously in Bush's mind, the Bush administration from the government of the United States. And that's why they're running around saying, if you speak out against the Bush administration, you are speaking out against the government of the United States. And therefore, you know, you're traitorous or treasonous or, you know, quack, quack, quack. And sorry, ain't the case. In fact, I'll share Teddy Roosevelt's thoughts about that with you when we come right back. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It's a really great day to size the nation, who just get in the way because their people have too much of a say. But boys, we have got the answer. Free trade.
Indeed.
It sounds really good. It spells freedom.
Yeah, right.
For the corporate brotherhood, and you need us in your neighborhood with new global employers.
Indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Coming up on 25 minutes till the hour. Yes, my government. Well, it turns out it's been said before. As Sue in the chat room pointed out to me, this is very interesting. We will work hand in hand, encouraging, sometimes leading, sometimes being led, rewarding. We will work on this in the White House and the cabinet agencies. I will go to the people and the programs that are the brighter points of light, and I will ask every member of my government to become involved. Yes, it was another president, George Herbert Walker Bush, in his inaugural address Friday, January 20th, 1989. So the Bushies apparently have a long tradition of referring to the United States government as their government, not our government. Fascinating. And the port thing, by the way, is continuing to melt down in front of us as we speak. You know, this. Although my prediction, I think this is going to be the case. What I've been suggesting all along is that ultimately this is going to go back to, it's going to be a done deal, because it's about the corporate agenda. And what people don't get is it's all about the corporate agenda. It's the corporatization of America started, well. I mean, you could say it started when America was founded. It really picked up steam in the 1880s. And then it got pushed back in the 1930s and the 1940s and the 1950s. And then they came back with a vengeance in the 1980s with Ronald Reagan. And ever since Ronald Reagan, it has been just rolling full tilt boogie faster and faster and faster to the point now where, you know, America for sale, as USA Today pointed out today, more than half of U.S. debt available for public purchase is held by foreigners, according to the Treasury Department. In December, foreigners owned $2.2 trillion in U.S. Treasury securities out of a total of $4 trillion privately held U.S. debt. More than a tenth of our crude oil and natural gas produced in the United States was produced by companies at least partially owned by foreign firms. 27 of the 145 U.S. refineries in 2003, the last year there were statistics available, were owned by foreign affiliated companies. Several foreign companies are involved in operating or managing several toll roads in the United States. For example, the Indiana Toll Road was just sold to an Australian company. No, it's actually it's a consortium, a Spanish company named known as Sintra and an Australian company, Mankery. Together they're running this thing. Mankery has operated the Skyway, an elevated highway in Chicago. They paid $4 billion for it. They take the toll money. They make the profits. Yeah, we get the road. But it's all about taking the profits out of America. Water. German and French companies control drinking water and wastewater services in one in 12 Americans. German utility RWE bought a company known near Philadelphia known as the American Water Company. American Water serves 18 million people in thousands of communities in 20 states. It's owned by the Germans. French utility Suez serves hundreds of cities in 18 states from Florida to California. In rail, 8,000 miles of our 140,000 route miles of track in the United States are owned by two Canadian companies, Canadian Pacific and CN, foreignly owned. Why? Because we have been pursuing since the 1980s trade policies that have essentially been bankrupting the United States. And when you're broke, and people come and they say, hey, you owe us some money. What are you going to do? And you don't have the money to give them. What do? You say, well, I can't pay you. You want to take my car? You want to take my coffee table? I'll give you my dining room set. How about this collection of old records and CDs? And that's what's been going on in the United States for 25 years. And so now about 20% of all the assets in the United States, including our ports, have been bought or leased by foreign companies or foreign individuals. And when those companies, when these foreign-owned companies operate in the United States, like Toyota building auto factories, I mean, they're a good corporate citizen, right? They employ people. Isn't that noble? But what happens with the profit that they make? I mean, they wouldn't be running a factory if they couldn't make a profit. Traditionally, if it was an American company, the profit would stay here in the United States. And that profit would be used to build other companies. But no, that profit's going back to Japan in the case of Toyota. In the case of Chrysler, that profit's going back to Germany. And that's what you're seeing with this deal with the ports in Dubai. Is that just, you know, very, very simply and very straightforwardly that this is part of the selling off of America. And yes, I think that there are some security concerns probably that are legitimate with regard to this, but frankly, they would be concerns regardless of who owns the ports. I'm not so concerned about the fact that it's a Dubai corporation as I am about the fact that it's any corporation that's based outside the United States. And that this is symptomatic of a larger issue. And that we've got in the Wall Street Journal, in the right-wing press, and on thinkprogress.org, in the left-wing press, you've got folks, bloggers and editorialists, saying things like, now this is from Faiz's piece on global leadership on thinkprogress.org. He says, progressives can and should embrace the reality of globalization. No! I'm sorry, globalization is the selling out of America. Or if you're a German, it's the selling out of Germany. Or if you're a Saudi, it's the selling out of Saudi Arabia. And it will not work. We tried globalization before. We tried it back in the late 1700s. It was tried by the British. The main vehicle of globalization was the East India Company, although there were hundreds of others. And what happened? Well, you know, a lot of countries around the world, a lot of people around the world said, no, we're not going to have any part of this. We don't want it. We don't think it's right. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Matt in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Hey, Matt.
Hey, guy. I've been listening to your show. Enjoy it. I've just got back from living in Dubai. I lived at the World Trade Center Towers over on Sheikh Zayed Road. Worked for Sheikh Maktoum with his Godolphin Racing organization. Have had a lot of time over there to observe kind of how they deal with the U.S. We would be making a huge mistake to ostracize this country. I hear a lot of the Democrats, and myself being a voting Democrat, when Clinton made the comment that she didn't want any, and you yourself have also just made this comment, any international company taking control of these ports, this has been going on for a long time. And even though I have no proof, very likely the Maktoums probably already owned that British company a long time ago. But we would be making a huge mistake by basically, it would be almost kind of racism, I think, that it was okay for a British company, but now that it's an Arab country and one that happens to be a key ally for us, now we're making a big hissy fit about it, and I think that would be a huge mistake.
Yeah, in the geopolitical, strategic, I don't disagree with you, Matt, and that was my point.
We have so few allies.
However, the distinction that's being made by a lot of politicians is that this is a company that's actually owned by the royal family that owns a country. So this is a country-owned company, and that's
correct.
Different from a publicly traded company. I have a problem with both, frankly.
Well, most of the companies in Dubai are owned by the Maktoum family.
Yeah.
But where the mistake is made is whether it's the Queen who owns the company in Britain or if it's Sheikh Maktoum. The problem is we're making a distinction that it's not just a problem that it's another country owning our ports. It's the fact that it's an Arab country. And that's what you're hearing. And you're hearing that from the right and the left.
And you're not hearing that here.
No. But
And that's my point.
The thing is I watched the Bill O'Reilly show last night and actually agreed with the man for the first time in my life, which is really scaring me. But he made a good point that this was almost overt racism against the Arab country, even in this day and age.
And you know why that is? And this is what Bill O'Reilly didn't tell you.
Be
the
afraid.
Reason for that
September
is
September the 11th. We saw tragedy
this
arrive
is George W.
on a
Bush's,
quiet morning.
This is George W. Bush's speech
danger,
to the RNC.
Killers. Be afraid.
This is
the
entirely from that one speech.
May God bless you.
Before the RNC.
God, Iraq, darkness. The continuing danger of terrorism. Be afraid. We have fought the terrorists across the earth. Evil. We are staying on the offensive.
On and on it goes. I mean, that's why that fear is there, is because George Bush has drilled it into us.
Well, and I understand that, and I'm not saying
he's
a threat to the man either. But the problem is, I lived in the UAE for 10 years, and have a pretty good grasp of the people that are there.
No, I'm agreeing with you, Matt. What I'm saying is that if right from the beginning, and I'm sorry, I'm getting a feedback from your phone that's just I've got to drop the call, but it's because it's blowing back and it sounded awful. But here's the bottom line, that the Bush administration has worked so hard.
In Iraq, the resurrection Saddam Hussein's secret police.
Yeah, to scare us about Arabs when they should have been dealing with 9/11 as this is a crime. There was a criminal who murdered our people, who flew these who organized this thing to fly these airplanes into the Twin Towers and whatnot. And the way Bill Clinton dealt with Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City, if he had dealt with it appropriately, rather than whipping up racism and anti-Islam fears, number one, we wouldn't have the world hating us. Number two, we wouldn't be at war in Iraq. And number three, we probably would have caught bin Laden and he'd be in jail someplace and it would be over. But Bush wouldn't have gotten as much political capital out of it. And this is his own efforts backfiring in his face. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
People of America, wrecked turtles and dolphins who were caught in the net, but it takes money to free all these pests, and that's a free trade barrier. Clean air is a luxury for some, but let's be fair, it's not for everyone, because goods are cheaper
If you release a little scum, defend your freedom of pollution.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you to announce that there must be no criticism of the president, or that we are to stand by the president, right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, but is morally treasonable to the American people. Thus saith President of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt, former President of the United States. As Pensito Review points out, Bush worshippers are already trying to make opposition to the president's deal on these ports about Democrats versus the dear leader. But in fact, you've got Republicans leading the most hysterical and racist end of this. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist freaking out about it. Denny Hastert, George Pataki, Robert Ehrlich. Now, as I said, I have some concerns about this. One of the concerns is that the law, there's this law that it's called the Byrd Amendment, that requires any sale of U.S. assets that may involve national security to automatically go through a 45-day investigation period. And that did not happen in this case. But the bottom line is, in all probability, when all is said and done, it would still go through because it's all about corporations. You have to understand, this is all about the corporate takeover, the multinational corporate takeover of not just the U.S., but of every country in the world. These guys want to see a world where there are no longer nation states. Gavin in Queens, New York. Hey, Gavin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great show. All you guys on Sirius Left, awesome work. Two quick points, Tom, before I forget, and I apologize. One is I take offense, and I think most Americans should take offense to the president's statement that this potentially anybody who raised an objection could be racist here because, frankly, all we're concerned about is the United States security.
Well, he's really trying to have it both ways, Gavin. On the one hand, he's saying that anybody who raises a concern is a racist, and on the other hand, he's whipping up racist fears.
Absolutely, I agree with you. And one thing that we're concerned about is not a private company owning part of America, but another government who has, we have proof, they had financed Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
Yeah, and therefore there should at the very least be this 45-day investigation period.
At the very least, and of course, we have three equal branches of government that should really vet this thing properly.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Gavin. Gavin, I got to move along. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Meryl in Everett, Washington. Hey, Meryl.
Oh, hello. Your story about the Americans dressed as Arabs reminded me that it was several months ago I heard a similar story on Air America, some program where a couple Brits were dressed, British were dressed as Arabs, and they were arrested, and the Brits took a tank and destroyed the prison to get them out.
That's right. That one actually hit the International Wire Service as a stand-up, straight-up story.
Yes. May I comment a little bit about the port situation?
Please.
That I think because there was apparently money laundering supporting the so-called alleged terrorists through the Dubai and that country, and also a couple of men from there, the aura of complicity is very strong, I think. And I heard that if we did not accept this offer, that we will be attacked. It's
say what?
That we would be attacked again if we don't let this.
Who said that?
I heard it on Air America, and I don't know who said it. I wish I could remember, but it's just...
Now, you know, actually, you could probably build a case, Meryl, for the idea that if we turn this down, then this would be interpreted in the Arab world as another slap against Arabs and Islam, as increasingly the Arab world is viewing our invasion of Iraq, by the way, and our continuing occupation of Afghanistan, and that would promote enough anti-American sentiment that some Muslim or Arab nutcase somewhere, some individual one or some small group or maybe even Al-Qaeda, would use that as an excuse to launch an attack against America. I could see the logic of building a case for that. It's certainly not, I don't think, though, that anybody would suggest that at the level of governments that would happen.
Well, I would just like to let the Arabs know that it's not an Arab issue, it's not a racial issue, it's been turned into one for diverting attention away from the perhaps criminal element that had been involved in 9/11 to start with. I think it's a smokescreen.
Yeah.
But thank you very much for listening.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for calling, Merrill. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Dan in Seattle, Washington. Dan, we have a minute left. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I was talking to a friend of mine about this port deal, and I told them that there's a possibility that a foreign company with a lot of scrutiny may actually be safer than an American company with Congress people in their pocket.
Well, you know, given Randy Cunningham and the Republicans in power, I'm sorry, I'm not gonna buy it, Dan. You're talking about a few congressmen who have been bought off versus a company that is owned by a royal family that countenances, shall we say, standards of human rights in life that we wouldn't accept here in the United States.
Do you know who the 12 people are that signed off on this? Is there a list of the 12 people that signed
off? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I believe it's in the New York Times today. Don Rumsfeld is one of them, by the way. John Snow is another one of them. Several members of the cabinet. There's this and what's really weird is that Rumsfeld then comes out and says, I don't know what this is all about. And yet he's one of the guys who signed off. They unanimously signed off on it back in February 12th, as I recall. Dan, I gotta wrap up the show. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. It's an ongoing story here. Frankly, I think that the port story is a much smaller story than the fact that Iraq is melting down into a civil war right now. And what are we going to do? Maybe it'll provide us with a good excuse to get the heck out of town. What a tragedy that we have created. What an absolute tragedy that we have created with this Bush adventure purely designed to promote the Republican Party in 2002 and 2004. It's a tragedy. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote again for the day from Teddy Roosevelt, who announced that there must be no criticism of the president, or that we are to stand by the president, right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, but is morally treasonable to the American people. At the same time, George W. Bush telling us that he's the one who owns and runs our government, not we the people. He's not even having the courtesy of the Queen. You know, this famous saying of Queen Elizabeth, my recollection is that this had something to do with the Beatles back in the 60s when one of the Beatles, something. In any case, the Queen made this famous comment where she said, "We are not amused," right? And, referring to herself. In the third person plural. George Bush, not quite there. Here's George W. Bush about his government.
The more people learn about the transaction that has been scrutinized and approved by my government, the more they'll be comforted that our ports will be secure.
There you go. My government. And here, really, the crux of the issue, I mean, the core of this issue, the key to understanding this issue, can be found in the first two paragraphs of an article on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. The headline, "In Ports Furor, A Clash Over Dubai." And here, this is the thing that the only person I've heard speak to this in the entire media over the last week was yesterday on the Keith Olbermann's program. David Sirota was on, essentially pointing this out. But here it is, the first two paragraphs on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, an article by Bernard Wysocki Jr., Michael Phillips, and Michael Schroeder. A Dubai-owned company's planned takeover of some operations at five American ports lays bare a growing conflict between the U.S. need for foreign capital and concerns about national security. You get that? The U.S. need for foreign... We are not just addicted to oil. They go on in the second paragraph. The quandary portends future clashes between free traders
and those troubled by the national security implications of allowing a free flow of investments from places such as China, India, and the oil-rich nations of the Middle East. And this, here we are. I mean, it's, I'm just amazed that, frankly, that all on right-wing radio, they're all basically huffing and puffing and saying, we've got to have free trade, we've got to, or, you know, and anybody who criticizes the president is a racist, or they're doing their racist rants, right, you know, stepping off from George W. Bush's, you know, be afraid.
Be afraid, yeah, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. The evil terrorists. Danger.
So anyhow, they're trying to have it both ways. They got, you know, Bush out there whipping up fears. That just montage from his RNC speech, his Republican National Convention speech in 2004. On the one hand, and on the other hand, on right-wing talk radio, trying to say, well, you know, nothing to worry about. On progressive talk radio, a lot of progressives very concerned about Dubai, and I think rightfully so. There are some serious issues here that need to be looked at, and I don't think that they have been thoroughly looked at because these guys are absolutely so in love with free trade that they just rushed into this thing. But the bottom line is that if we're deciding that the rules of the game are that America's for sale, and America's for sale because we want to buy so much cheap junk from China and other countries, and we want when you dial 411 or whatever, we want our phones to be answered, or technical service for Dell, you want your phone answered in India. If we've decided that we want all of our work done outside the United States, we want all our corporate profits being generated outside the United States, except for the retail end of it, and we just want to be a nation that basically buys stuff, sits around, watches TV, and buys stuff, then we're going to become debtors. It's like the family that sits around and has an income of, say, you know, $1,000 a month, but decides this month that they're going to buy that new plasma TV for $2,000, and next month they're going to buy they're going to take a cruise for $2,000 in the month, and on top of that they're paying for the house and for the food and for the car and everything, and it all adds up, and they're broke. And the day of reckoning comes when the debtors, the people, the debtees, I guess you'd say, the holders of their debt, come and say, you know, you haven't made your car payment in 6 months. We want something. We'd like the car. And this is the metaphorical equivalent of it. We have been, we had $700 billion last year that we bought in more stuff from the rest of the world than we sold to the rest of the world. And so the rest of the world is saying, hey, you know, we don't want to buy the junk you make in America anymore because all the good stuff they're making in China and Japan, if you don't believe it, just look in any American store. I mean, that's really the perspective. I mean, that's clearly the message that the Walmart family wants to send to us. And so the rest of the world is saying, you know, we don't want to buy American-made stuff. Nobody wants American-made stuff. But we will buy your ports. We'll buy your oil companies. We'll buy your telecommunications companies. We'll buy your retailers. We'll buy, you know, we'll buy your mines. We'll buy leases on federal land to extract oil, to extract gold, to take out copper. You know, that's no problem. We'll do that. And so to maintain our lifestyle, we're doing the equivalent of that family that I was describing to you a minute ago, saying, well, okay, we owe you a bunch of money. Why don't you take the first half of the front yard? We'll sell you that. And they say, okay, fine, that's worth $5,000. We'll go down and cut a deed for that. Now we own the first half of your front yard. And then we buy some more junk, and they come back and they say, hey, you owe us even more money. Well, why don't you take the backyard? Okay, cool, we'll take the backyard. And we go down to the recorder of deeds, and we file that now the guy down the street owns our backyard. And we keep on buying stuff without selling things to other people, without having an income. And the credit card company or the people who are holding our debt, they come to us, and they say, you still owe us. You still owe us. Well, you can have my garage. Okay, fine, I'll take your garage. That's worth $3,000 or $10,000, whatever it is. So we'll take the garage. And we go down and we sign a deed, and then they come back, you know, 6 months later, you know, you're still buying stuff from us, and you don't have any money to pay us. You still got to pay us. You have to, you know, own. What are you going to give us? Well, how about my dining room furniture and my living room furniture? Okay, you can have that. Okay, we'll take that.
You get what's going on here? This is America being auctioned off. And when it was just our car companies, when it was just the Germans buying Chrysler, when it was just the Germans buying Random House, our publishing companies, when it was just the French buying Simon & Schuster, when it was just the Saudis buying, you know, our oil refineries from Texaco, when it was just the Japanese building auto factory, you know, nobody paid much attention to it. Gee, isn't that nice? They called it insourcing. The cons came up with a whole new phrase for it. It's insourcing. Insourcing is a marvelous thing. They're going to come into America, and they're going to hire us to do stuff for them, to make goods that we can sell to ourselves, and they're going to make a profit on it, sure. And they're going to take that profit home with them, yeah. But we're going to not notice that, because it's globalization and it's good, don't you know? And now we're down to the point where we're saying, where they're coming to us and they're saying, yeah, you're still buying stuff from us, you still owe us money. And so if you want some cash, we'll buy your front door and access to walk through it. And if you don't want to sell it to us, you got a problem. Because you sold us everything else. Because you're broke now. Because you've got no way to stop us from buying it, basically. Because you've put everything up for sale. What we're seeing here is the fruit of economic policies, international trade policies, and domestic economic policies as well, that began under Ronald Reagan. The whole idea of globalization and internationalization that began with Ronald Reagan, that became overt and full-blown with George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton, and that are being aggressively pursued by George W. Bush. We are simply seeing the fruit of this, as the Wall Street Journal, of all things, points out on the front page, first two paragraphs, a Dubai-owned company's planned takeover of some operations at five American ports lays bare a growing conflict between the U.S. need for foreign capital. Now, as we keep buying stuff, somebody's got to give us the money to buy it. Where are we going to get that money from? Well, we'll sell our ports. And concerns about national security. Well, maybe we shouldn't sell our front door. Well, I'm sorry. You started this game. Yeah, Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush, you guys started this game. It wasn't the Arabs who started this game. It was us. 16 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Last night I'm in the gay room smoking. Tonight I'm giving up you. Well, I've had just about all I can stand of those worthless cigarettes.
There you go. At the bottom of the hour, actually, we're going to have Frederica Pereira with us. She's a professor of environmental health. And going to be talking about an interesting... We had, earlier in the week, we had a free trader on, as it were, saying, there should be no laws to stop secondhand smoke from being in the air. We're going to talk about some of the interesting discoveries about this. And we're going to continue talking about this whole port thing. Just since George Bush came into office, you got my metaphor of the front door being sold, and, you know, after we sold off the front lawn and the back lawn, just since George Bush came into office, we have sold... This is called direct foreign investment, is the phrase that is used to describe this. $142.8 billion of America to investors in the United Kingdom, $91 billion of America to investors in Canada, $86 billion of America to investors in France, $84 billion of America to investors in Switzerland, $78 billion of America to investors in the Netherlands, and $4,100 million of America to investors in the Middle East. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service is with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Well, I spent my morning at, I have in front of me, it is 217 pages long, the federal response to Hurricane Katrina lessons learned.
Ah, yes.
Which this is 125 recommendations.
Right.
If one looks at this in a benign way, a number of these recommendations are very good. The difficulty is in implementing them.
Bush administration looking at itself here now.
This is what is difficult. This is what I think would be difficult for almost any bureaucracy, and that was basically the substance of my question of Fran Townsend, the President's Assistant on Homeland Security, with Secretary Chertoff as the head of the Department of Homeland Security, you know, and he's been called curiously, you know, disengaged, and his department was called alarming during Katrina. Can these things be done? And, you see, a number of things have to be done by, according to this report, by the 1st of June, the beginning of the hurricane season, which is very ambitious.
Now, is Bush acknowledging that it was Tuesday, or maybe it was Wednesday, I believe it was Tuesday, the hurricane, of course, hit ground, you know, over the weekend, it was Wednesday that his staff put together the DVD of news reports to show him what was really going on?
Well, only the beginnings of questions have been asked today, and the report is fairly generic, I would say, when it comes to who knew what, when, and who was to blame for what. It blames the federal government, emergency plans at all levels. It says, let me just find it here, blah, 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 blah. It says that the entire government failed. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't single out any individuals, which I didn't really expect, but it doesn't. And it doesn't call for any resignations or suggest any actions against anybody. It seems to be far more a look at, okay, these are the lessons learned. Not even so much that this is what went wrong, although there is some of that. These are lessons learned. Let's move on. And certainly there seems to be no calling for heads rolling.
Yeah, amazing. Now, so with this report, the Bush administration is separating itself from the government, and they're saying that the administration itself didn't have failures, but the government had failures, if my interpretation of what I've read so far is correct.
It talks about the federal government, and within that, I have to take that to mean that it does mean itself. I mean, President Bush said today, after his cabinet meeting, I wasn't satisfied with the federal response to the hurricane.
Right. But in that case, he's separating himself. Here, listen to this clip, Victoria. This is George W. Bush saying that the government is his, that it's not his administration, it's his government.
The transaction that has been scrutinized and approved by my government.
My government. I mean, it's like when it's what he wants, he owns the government. But when it's something he did wrong, it's that government over there. It's the federal government.
Right, and I think that is the difference between this report and the House report, House Republican Committee report, which was 520 pages, and that called it a failure of leadership from the White House down. It also didn't make specific recommendations, and don't forget, we've got probably in the next month or so, we've got the Senate report coming out, which is bipartisan.
We only have a minute left, Victoria, and I have just two quick questions for you. Number one, what's happening in Washington, D.C. with regard to the fact that a civil war is breaking out in Iraq? And number two, what's coming out of this whole port thing?
Well, the hearings are going on as we speak, and I wasn't able to attend them because I was at Katrina, so I'm woefully uninformed on that, I'm afraid.
On the port thing?
On the port thing. In terms of what's going on in Iraq, there is tremendous concern, and there's starting to be a little bit of finger-pointing in terms of, well, I told you this was going to happen, I told you this was going to happen. This is the scenario that they have really, really dreaded, and now I think there's going to be a major effort to try and, try and rein it in before it gets completely out of hand.
The Sunni leaders have already said that they're no longer going to participate with the creation of a government until the people who are assassinating Sunnis are brought to heel, which is the Shias. And the Shias are feeling wronged because their Golden Dome got blown up. Is there any way out?
Nobody wants to hear the word civil war.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you, we've got one. We've got a full-blown civil war on our hands. It sure looks like it to me anyway. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thank you for being with us today. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting for a Change.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. I'm not sure what they're going to say, so I'm not going. Here we go. Exposing the con and conservative. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. As promised, Dr. Frederica Pereira, a professor of environmental health at Columbia University and director of the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health, is with us. She's a leading expert on air pollution and its impact on children's health. And on Monday, Dr. Pereira, first of all, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
And the website for your center is cceh.org, is that correct?
It's cceh.org.
Right, okay, three C's,
yep.
EH.org, triple C, okay. And on Monday in our program, we had a fellow on who was going on and on and on about how we really, as a society, had no business regulating public smoking. So the possibility of secondhand smoke is simply, you know, a choice that people make, whether they want to breathe it or not, and they should be able to make that choice. And one of the points I think that is often made in arguments against smoking in public places is that you know, a large portion of our population, a not insignificant portion of our population anyway, not a majority, but a good chunk of our population, are not of an age to make a choice. We're talking children who are exposed to secondhand smoke. And you've found some startling discoveries about the consequences of secondhand smoke on humans.
Well, that's right. I think the effects of secondhand smoke really are well known in terms of the of fetal growth and developmental problems in children, and also secondhand smoke is a trigger for asthma in children, and secondhand smoke is also a known cancer-causing exposure. And in our work, we have actually been studying non-smoking pregnant women and their children, following them for a number of years, and we've shown that in utero exposure to the mother's secondhand smoking in the womb, that is to say when the fetus is exposed via the mother's being a secondhand or passive smokers, the babies are smaller at birth and they do score less well on tests of mental development when they're several years old. So our findings are consistent with the literature, and secondhand smoke is something that really shouldn't occur around pregnant women and young children. These are vulnerable stages, and we tell the women in our study to ask smokers in the home to take it outside, smoke elsewhere. Don't smoke around the women when they're pregnant and around the children.
Yeah, or chew gum or take a patch or something.
Exactly.
Now,
but we did find that 40% of the women reported some smoking by others in the home, even though they themselves were non-smokers.
Right. Now, you also found DNA damage as a result of exposure to secondhand smoke.
Well, we found DNA damage as a result of exposure to combustion-related pollutants in air that we had measured. We had measured the pollutants in the air the mother was breathing during pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And what people don't realize often is that many of the pollutants to which a mother is exposed through what she's breathing or eating, drinking, actually cross the placenta and do reach the baby. We found that the exposure to these pollutants in the air that she was breathing during pregnancy, called hydrocarbons, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, way too big a term. We abbreviate as PAHs.
Mm-hmm.
The higher the levels of that exposure, the more genetic damage we found in the cord blood of the babies when they were born. We took a small sample of blood that otherwise would have been discarded, and we analyzed that.
Now,
this kind of genetic damage is a red flag, a warning that there's a possibly increased risk of cancer later on. It doesn't
right.
mean cancer, but it is a warning sign.
Right. Now, is this type of genetic damage the sort of thing that
you know, I understand, for example, that when a woman is born, she's born essentially with all the eggs in her ovaries that she will have throughout her life.
Mm-hmm.
So if she is forming as a fetus, those eggs are being developed, and if they're being genetically damaged, if the DNA in her own eggs is being damaged, then we literally could see the old biblical thing of, you know, down onto the seventh generation, you know, this DNA damage being passed from generation to generation, even when the smoking is no longer present?
Well, in fact, this could get complicated, but smoking could affect, and air pollution exposures that are toxic to genes can be toxic in several ways, not only by changing the structure of the genes, but also by changing the way they're translated into proteins, their expression. Mm-hmm. So, and there's some evidence that these effects are what you call heritable, inherited across generations. I think where we're getting in our discussion is the need for prevention of exposures wherever we can,
right.
Exposures to environmental, external contaminants that we are now showing to be harmful to the babies in the womb and in childhood. And we've talked about the secondhand smoke and the air pollution. We've also been studying pesticide exposures, and we see with these very common urban pollutants that there are multiple signs of concern, such as babies being smaller at birth when they are exposed to these three kinds of pollutants. and that's of concern because smaller birth size is an indicator that children may have more health and developmental
right.
problems in childhood.
We're not only poisoning ourselves and our children, but we're poisoning future generations as well.
Well, and we could be affecting that child over his or her entire lifetime. We've also found that these babies have more respiratory problems when they are several years of age. And so these are signs, I think, that we need to take more preventive action, and prevention it's best to start as young as you can, and let's start in the womb.
Yeah.
The good news, though, is that these are exposures that are by their nature preventable, and we can talk about some of the strategies.
Well, we're out of time, but I think it's remarkable what you're doing, and I want to refer people to your website, CCCEH.org. And is that the Columbia Center for Children's and Environmental Health, or for Children's Environmental
That's
Health?
The Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health. That's
.org.
Right.
And Dr. Frederica Pereira, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
I very much appreciate your coming on the program and sharing your time and your insights with us.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And we're going to move back. I wanted to get that information out there and punctuate it. There's an article about her and her work in the current issue of Discover magazine that's fascinating, and wanted to get that out. But I want to get back to some of these larger political issues that are looming as well. And in fact, let's go to your phone calls and get into this. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Jeff. Great to hear from you again.
Excuse me?
Great to hear from you again.
Nice to be back. And by the way, just based on your last guest's comments, I just got back from a country where I couldn't get away from secondhand smoke.
You were in Europe?
Yeah, I was in Greece. Countries.
Yeah, and, I've been in Greece, yeah.
Had severe respiratory problems that I had to return home because of, and the secondhand smoke was probably one of the biggest reasons I had to come home.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, about this thing of the ports, a couple things. I think we can really develop some empathy from this thing of, look at our reactions to the UAE taking over our ports.
Right.
Now picture a much bigger thing on the other hand, of having, say, the UAE come in and build military bases all around our country and have their soldiers walk around our cities doing things that are overtly obscene to us, I mean, that violate our religious standards. How would we react to
right.
that?
So, having four wives, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So picture what it would be, what... You know, try to develop some empathy for what it's been like for years all around the world.
Yeah.
With the
or,
US having some...
you know, or for example, in Nicaragua, you know, imagine that if, you know, we go down and we buy their plantations and operate them, and they're looking at it going, hey, that's not us. You know, yeah.
Cuba with Batista, you know,
yeah.
U.S. Foods or whatever, U.S. brands?
Yeah.
Run things there?
Yeah, it was U.S. No, it wasn't. I forget the name of the company. Yeah, yeah. You're right, though. The big fruit company. U.S. Fruit, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah. No, but anyway, you see why people react to us. So yeah. Use this to develop some empathy for what's been going on the other way around the world.
Yeah, good point.
The next thing is with ports. I just toured the port in Antwerp.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an epiphany. I mean, you go there, and the scale that you're used to living at is so changed. That's where a semi-truck is a tiny thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on just a medium-sized cargo ship. It's about 6,000 containers, 22-foot containers.
Yeah, my brother-in-law is a sea captain and has steered those things. they're massive, 1,000 feet long.
Yeah, and you see the sheer impossibility of, like here's a container that's being loaded in 24 hours. It has, 6,000-plus containers. You've got to do about 3 containers a minute inspecting these.
Right, and each container is a semi-truck.
Yeah, and that's just one ship.
Right.
There are multiple ships being loaded in these ports.
Well, this is why the suggestions, Jeff, the suggestion that has been made is that we inspect all of the cargo at the point of exit before it actually gets into the port. And the cost to put U.S. Customs Service inspectors on U.S. civil service payrolls, complete with pensions and everything, to inspect every single piece of cargo that's going into every single container that's going into every single ship before it heads to the United States, $8 billion a year. And the Bush administration said, no, we can't afford that. And yet we're spending more. We're spending about $5 billion a year right now. Jeff, I we're out of time, but thank you for the call. We're spending about $5 billion a year right now on the frisking granny at the airports, which is larger than the budget for the FBI. I mean, it's crazy. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I can almost hear the echoes of the past. From the voices of the years gone by so fast.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, 98 detainees have died in U.S. custody now. In only 12 of 34 cases, has anyone been punished for confirmed or suspected killing, according to Human Rights First, anyone in the American military. This Dateline Baghdad by the Associated Press. Abusive GIs not pursued, survey finds. The longest sentence for any member of the American military linked to a torture-related death of a detainee in Iraq or Afghanistan has been 5 months. In only 12 of 34 cases, has anyone been published? Beyond those cases, has anyone been punished? Beyond those cases, in almost half of 98 known detainee deaths since 2002, the cause was never announced or was reported as undetermined. So, we can say, oh, gee, are bad, but the fact of the matter is that the people in Iraq are looking at this, and they happen to know these people. I mean, it's people from their neighborhood. As Jeff in Colorado, in Denver, said, just imagine if this country was occupied. What if Mexico decided, George Bush, he's not a good president. We need to just evict him. And they came to save us from Bush, from the Bush regime. He wasn't actually elected. His cronies of his daddy, who his father had put on the Supreme Court, made him president. And so Mexico invades the United States. They throw out the Bush administration. They got George locked up in jail someplace for a trial for crimes against humanity. And they're stomping around our cities. And, the guy down the street gets taken off to prison and gets tortured and dies. You going to be happy about that? What are you going to do? Well, I think we're finding out. Karen in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Karen, welcome to the program.
Fine. How are you?
Great. Thanks for listening on WTKG there, right?
That's right. Yeah.
What's up, Karen?
I called once before. Jeff from Denver pretty much put some of the, in a different way, what I wanted to say. American corporations over the years have been raping other countries. They've been going into developing countries and, setting up, taking advantage of cheap labor. And now they're raping their own citizens by outsourcing stuff, and a lot of that stuff is very sensitive material, such as data processing of very private information in Pakistan and India, etc. I'm not just talking about jobs. I'm talking about,
No, see, you call your insurance company to talk about a claim about something that may be very, very private, and you may well be talking to somebody in India who
right.
is typing that information in.
Yeah.
Right, who's typing that information into a computer in India that's going to end up who knows where.
Right, exactly, and we know that the internet is not that safe anyway. That if somebody's really wants to get at our private stuff, they can. But why are we opening ourselves up to it?
Yeah.
But it's American corporations who are doing the outsourcing, because they say it's so costly here, who are raping Americans.
Yeah, I agree with you, Karen, and you said it very well. And in fact, it was started by Jack Welch. Jack Welch of General Electric was the first guy to go to India and say, hey, we can do a deal here. The Wall Street Journal did a nice profile of it back about 10 years ago. Sean in Sacramento, California. Hey, Sean.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I love your show, and I've been listening for a few months now.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, I just wanted to say that, you know, I really think on this Dubai port issue that, you know, the administration has done it to itself. You know, when they're using rhetoric such as, you know, you're either with us or for us, an Islamic Arab threat, you know, they've really kind of, and we're in Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11.
Right.
They've basically created an atmosphere that, you know, like when they say things like we're over there, so we don't have to face them here.
Right.
You know,
it creates an over there in our mind. Yeah. They're creating these dualities.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree with you, Sean. They're trying to have it both ways. They're trying to have us be afraid of Muslims by and large, and use that fear as a political weapon or tool. And at the same time, they want their money, because we've got to have their money, because the Bushies and the Reagans and the Clintons sold off our country. You know, they sold us out. Alice, and thank you, by the way, for listening on KSAC in Sacramento. Alice in Humboldt County, KGOE in Eureka. Hey, Alice.
Okay, Tom. I keep wondering how the Republicans could hope to get away with causing us so much damage. The answer comes down to one thing. It doesn't matter what the people think. We control the elections. Tom, I think it would help if every time you talk to any member of the Congress, you try to make them aware of this.
That we need to control our election systems.
That's right.
Yes, I agree, Alice. By the way, this month is your 92nd birthday, isn't it?
Oh, that was the 9th.
Oh, that well, happy birthday.
And I had a great-grandson born on the 18th. So
oh, that's marvelous.
He's my buddy.
That's marvelous. Well, Alice, thanks so much for calling. You always have a pithy comment to share with us, and we always appreciate it. Great to hear
okay.
from you. Thank you. Bye now. It's Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary on
Boy,
WPTT.
That was got right on here. Now, hopefully I can finish, and I don't mean to be negative. I can finish my comments. I think, and correct me if you feel I'm mistaken about this. I don't. This is the way I feel, and this is the way I strongly feel. I keep saying it, but I'm not so sure anybody in America, maybe you, is addressing this. That how long we can stop blaming the politicians and look at ourselves right in the eyeballs, and say that we're smugging our own power.
Well,
even Democrats.
Yes, and at a real significant level, Gary, this is the result of our having been lied to by the people that we elected. This is the result of people who were ideologues who came into power, into political power, and said, trust us, we're going to give you jobs, we're going to give you low-cost goods, we're going to make everything fine. And what they were doing was systematically selling off America. And as I said, it started with Ronald Reagan. It went to George Herbert Walker Bush. Bill Clinton got in on the game. And now George W. Bush is doing it. And it's all about selling out America. It's all about absolute, unbridled, laissez-faire capitalism. And very few people, frankly, are talking about this. George Soros is talking about it. David Sirota is talking about it. I'm talking about it. And most people are looking at the, you know, they're looking at the great wizard rather than what's behind the curtain. 57 minutes before the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to the radio support group up by and for We the People of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman radio program. Harvey J. Kay, K-A-Y-E, is the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. I got to tell you, this is one of the best books I have ever read on American history, and I've read a whole pile of books on American history. If there is no book that you read this year, buy Thomas Paine and the Promise of America and read it. It's absolutely astounding. And we are going to get back to conversations about what's going on in Iraq right now. I've got some amazing quotes from you for you from October of 2002. What's happening with this whole thing with regard to the port of Dubai and the other hot topics of the day. But I just wanted to take a moment out of our day here and talk about what brought us to America in the first place, and what is the ideal? What are the goals? What is the vision that this country can and should be holding? Harvey Kay, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you with us, Harvey. You have written an absolutely brilliant book. You're using Thomas Paine as really the lever or the fulcrum point, the center point for this, but it's really you describe the entire arc of American history.
Yeah, I've been wondering for a long time how it is that Americans continually reach back to the American Revolution looking for answers to contemporary questions. And one of the things I realize is that whether we read about the American Revolution or we study history, we carry the legacy of the American Revolution with us. And I think the legacy of the man in particular that we embrace, even if we don't know a great deal about him, is Thomas Paine.
And the reason why?
Well, it was Paine who really imbued American history with the aspiration that we had a responsibility to deepen and extend, to create, and then to extend and deepen freedom, equality, and democracy. And in every generation since the American Revolution, there have been Americans, liberals, radicals, progressives, we'll call them progressives, who recognized what their responsibilities were, and they reclaimed Paine's memory and struggled for that democratic ideal. You know, free thinkers, the working men's movement, the suffragists, the populists, the progressives, the socialists, all the way through the 1960s and Students for Democratic Society and Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And what I'm wondering is to what extent we still carry that spirit. And my book was intended to tell Americans, look, we know what we're fighting against. This is what we ought to remember we're fighting for.
And Harvey Kay, what is it that we should be fighting for? What is it that all those different groups throughout those generations have brought forward and said, this is what we're holding up?
Well, what they realized is that the price of liberty is not simply eternal vigilance. The price of liberty is that we have to give to our children the freedom, equality, and democracy that we inherited and extend it even further if it's going to survive. And that means that questions of race, class, and gender need to be questions of how to reduce the inequalities, how to extend the freedoms, how to guarantee American democracy. And look, I mean, you and I both know we're facing a crisis of unparalleled proportions. I'm not sure if we're the same age. I'm 56.
We're 2 years apart.
2 years apart. I find myself saying, this is the worst presidency that I can ever recall. I feel like this is far worse than Reagan, far worse. I even wonder to what extent this is worse than Nixon, because in the time of Nixon, one felt that there was still an impulse and a struggle underway, and now we've got diverse struggles, and we need to unify these struggles.
Yeah, it, very much so. We're talking with Harvey Kay. He's the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. You're also a Rosenberg professor at
University of Wisconsin in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
There it is.
Which I will tell you, I'm very proud to be from Green Bay these days because, as the New York Times sports writer, whose name I'm forgetting, once said, socialism is alive and well in Green Bay, and he had in mind the Green Bay Packers were the only non-privately owned national sports franchise.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
it's owned by the community?
It's essentially owned by the community. People buy stock at $200 a share, and you don't get dividends for it. It's a statement of one's commitment to the team. It's owned by a trust, basically.
And instead, do you get tickets or something?
Not even that. The tickets are sold out for life. I've lived in Green Bay now half my life, and I have yet to be able to buy tickets.
Wow.
But fortunately, my dentist is the team dentist, and he takes me a few times a year.
That's great.
But, you know, it's really quite interesting because, in some ways, what we have here in Green Bay is this real sort of American democratic ideal.
Right.
The NFL would have loved to have taken our team away.
Sure.
But they can't because it's essentially community-owned.
They wanted to privatize it. Now, we're looking at privatizing
well, I guess the privatization of our ports was a done deal back several decades ago. You know, Reagan really began this thing full tilt boogie, the selling off of America, and taking us from basically a creditor nation where we owned ports in other countries, or our companies did, to being the largest debtor nation on earth.
Yeah, I mean, how many people realize how many of the other ports are managed by foreign companies?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's incredible.
It really is incredible. And, I think of what would Thomas Paine do if he were here today?
Well, right? That was my question.
I mean, what Thomas Paine would do today is he would say to his fellow Americans, look, okay, we have a responsibility to ourselves and to the world, and that is to create a model of people governing themselves. But he would ask, to what extent have we given up our own powers and liberties to these global corporations? You know, it isn't just this particular company that we should be concerned about. We should be concerned about the sale of our assets everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the point that I've been making for weeks now, for years now.
Yeah, no, listen, we don't. Okay. You're not on air here in Green Bay these days, yeah. But I pick you up every day on the Internet.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So Harvey Kay, the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, what I'd like to do is we have about 3 or 4 minutes here left in this segment. I'm wondering if you could just give us a quick thumbnail overview of the generations that have recaptured this vision of, we don't want the corporations running this country, and we don't want a conservative elite running this country. We want we the people to run this country.
Well, that's great.
Quickie history lesson.
I mean, first of all, most historians assume that Thomas Paine's memory had been suppressed. And what I realized is that it was carried forward in every generation. So you've got the working men's movements of the 1820s, and then you've got the free thinkers of those times. You've got the suffragists. And the abolitionists. And then you've got, and on throughout American history. Now, what's interesting is some of the greatest Americans, the people who we celebrate, were themselves Paineites, but we often don't realize it, like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Walt Whitman, Herman Melville, Mark Twain, Abraham Lincoln. Some of the finest speeches in American history drew on that kind of spirit. Franklin Roosevelt at the outset of World War II. John Kerry, appearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1971,
as a young man,
explaining the Vietnam Veterans Against the War's position, how they named themselves the Winter Soldiers in the spirit of Thomas Paine. I want to say there's a national organization, Veterans for Common Sense, headquartered in Washington with chapters in various places like Sarasota, Florida. And these guys have modeled themselves in the spirit of Thomas Paine. Those are the ideals. They're asking questions about torture. They're asking questions about NSA spying. Veterans for Common Sense. You can find them on the web.
Now, Thomas Paine in the 1780s and 1790s, after the American Revolution, when he wrote the Rights of Man, was the first American that I can find, and correct me if I'm wrong, to lay out a really comprehensive, detailed plan, I'd say, for what became ultimately the New Deal.
Absolutely. I mean, Thomas Paine not only envisioned an independent America, he envisioned an America that would also be a model to the world. And part of his vision of the future was the idea that if you could get rid of aristocrats, if you could get rid of kings, you'd save so much money that you could create pensions for the elderly, you could provide stake holdings for young people, for education, for buying a business, for buying land. Essentially, he envisioned the New Deal. He envisioned a social democratic kind of political system in which we would attend to the needs of working people. And he said it wasn't charity. These were fundamental rights.
Yeah, and he also talked about a maximum number of hours per week. He talked about minimum wages rather than maximum wage laws, which actually were in place back then.
Yeah, right.
He talked about progressive taxation.
Paine himself, before he came to America, his last effort in England before he came to America in 1774 was that he was the spokesperson for an effort to raise the wages of he and his fellow customs officers. He was an early labor organizer.
Right, as a federal employee.
Right, as an employee of the British government. That's right.
Yeah, interesting. So, and he also argued in favor of essentially a social security system.
Right, that was real. Even today, if you go to the Social Security website, I believe you will see that the godfather of Social Security is Thomas Paine.
Amazing.
I mean, what a legacy he left us. And we progressives need to reclaim that legacy and reassert it against these guys who are not only stealing history, they're stealing our future.
Yeah, and our children's future and our grandchildren's future and the 230 some odd years of of the glory of this nation. I don't know how to say it beyond that. So many generations have fought and died to keep freedom intact.
I know you got to go, but I know you got to go because time's running out. But I'll tell you something. We tune your work on Jefferson and mine on Payne. We could do a hell of a good two-man show.
Well, I think we just did. Thomas Paine and the Promise of America is the book. Buy it and read it. Harvey J. K., the author. Harvey K., thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman Radio Program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. And in the spirit of Thomas Paine, a man inspired by Thomas Paine, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, talking about how the new royalists of the economic order, this is from his 1936 speech before the Democratic Party in Philadelphia, as I recall, in July of 1936, when he was renominated to run for president of the United States, how the big business basically had established itself as a royalty in the United States, and they had to be brought down. Franklin Roosevelt.
Private enterprise, indeed, became too private. It became privileged enterprise, not free enterprise.
And this is where it began, said Franklin Roosevelt, and this privileged enterprise that he was talking about said, you can vote, but you can't have a job.
The royalists I have spoken of, the royalists of the economic order, have conceded that political freedom was the business of the government, but they have maintained that economic slavery was nobody's business.
And they continue to maintain that, by the way. What? Ports?
They granted that the government could protect the citizen in his right to vote, but they denied that the government could do anything to protect the citizen in his right to work and his right to live.
Yeah, and now they're even saying that the citizen doesn't have the right to vote. He's got to hand that over to Diebold. But in any case, Roosevelt continued.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power.
And
our allegiance. And our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
When was the last time we had a president who talked like that, who said, our allegiance to America requires the overthrow of corporate power? It's amazing, he went on.
In vain, they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution.
And they still do, by the way.
But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for.
And they stand for... Right. I'll let Roosevelt say it.
Now, as always, for over a century and a half, the flag, the Constitution, stand against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike.
And
the flag and the Constitution stand for democracy, not tyranny. For freedom, not subjection.
There you go. And freedom from corporate rule. That was a president who got reelected three times. The President of the United States four times. In fact, the Republicans were so freaked out by Franklin Roosevelt that they passed an amendment to the Constitution of the United States to make it only legal for a president to have two terms, something that now they're talking about changing again. Emil in Spokane. Is it Spokane or Spokane, Washington, Emil?
Yes, this thing of giving our ports away to a foreign, I'm a naturalized citizen.
Yes, sir.
And I don't think we should give this away to our enemies.
Well, I'm not sure the UAE are our enemies.
Well, you know, I was born over there, and it's a whole different society over there.
Yes.
Believe me.
No,
they're
I do.
Our enemies.
You think so?
They may make money with us, you see.
Yeah.
But their underlying ideology, if you will, is to eradicate all of non-believers.
Yeah, ultimately, I don't think we can universally make that statement, but there's certainly a lot of that going on in the Middle East right now. Good point, Emil. Thank you very much. Ron in Renton, Washington. Hey, Ron.
Yeah, and wasn't it just a few short weeks ago that they were talking about Bin Laden on a tape saying he's going to be able to invade us again or cause some kind of an attack on us? Well, what better way would be, you know, for him to do that than, you know, have a friend in Dubai and, you know, in the port business to be able to smuggle people in?
Well, the fact of the matter is, Ron, that this is, you know, I hate to say it, but this is where George Bush is right. It doesn't matter who owns the company. If they want to smuggle themselves into the company and get into this country, in all probability, they would be able to do it. Or, you know, for that matter, the way that we've set things up right now, and this is the tragedy of it all, the way we've set things up right now, whoever owns the port makes the profit from all the business that goes on in the port, and you and I pay for the security. You and I, our government, our taxes are making sure that that doesn't happen. Hopefully, well. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue. If you drive a big V8, it's time to celebrate. They're gonna fight a war for you. To keep gas prices cheap, so when you drive or when you sleep, you can do it in an air-conditioned room. For driving is your right, so let's get out there and fight. You can read that in the Constitution. I go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate that red, white, and blue.
And welcome back, my friends. Indeed, 34 minutes after the hour, coming up on 25 minutes before. Katrina Vandehuvel, this is great, over in The Nation. It's over at The Nation blog, actually, thenation.com/blogs, etc. And she just comes right out and says it. She says, you know, the Bush administration has jumped to the defense of Dubai Port World, not because the company has operated internationally, not because it hosts more U.S. Navy ships than any other country in the region, which it does. And don't be fooled, she says, when the president says, I want those who are questioning it to explain why all of a sudden a Middle Eastern company is held to a different standard. She says, the fact is the administration is defending this deal because their guiding principle is one of maximizing profits. Not surprisingly, the Bush administration had significant business ties to DP World. And then she goes through talking about David Sanborn and Jon Snow, who, you know, I told you about, what, last Friday, last week. In any case, and points out that in 2002, the Coast Guard estimated they needed $5.4 billion over 10 years to make the necessary improvements to the nation's ports. And last year, the Bush administration appropriated only $175 million. It's a little teeny tiny bit for all that's needed. So, you know, the bottom line, it's all about the bucks. But I'd say it's not even about the bucks for the Bushies. It's about the bucks for the Bushies and all their friends. It's about the ideology. It's about the ideology that multinational corporations should rule the world, which includes the United States of America, rather than the people of any individual country. The people of any individual country should have no say in it whatsoever, say the Bushies. By the way, a number of people in the chat room asked, what speech was that Roosevelt was giving? That was from his
1936 acceptance speech before the Democratic Party in July. My recollection, it was July 24th, but I could be wrong. Anyhow, it was in July of 1936. I do remember that, and I'm quite certain it was Philadelphia. And you should be able to easily Google it. The entire speech is absolutely brilliant. In fact, you'll find the entire speech reprinted as an appendix in my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. 1-866-440-8466, our phone number, Gary in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Gary.
You know, regarding Tom Snow, or Secretary of Treasury Snow, I heard yesterday an article, an author of an article in the December issue of U.S. News and World Report, anyway, about Dubai. He said that Secretary Snow earned $100 million from the sale of the company he was in charge of, SEA or SEX, to Dubai.
CSX,
and
yeah.
Several million of that was deferred income yet to be paid. And he's on the committee that's making this decision. How come there's not a conflict of interest there?
Well, in the world of multimillionaires and billionaires, folks like Jon Snow and George W. Bush, I mean, they just don't care about that kind of stuff. I mean, you say, you know, Dick Cheney's sitting on all these Halliburton stock options right now that have gone from, you know, being worth very little when he became president because he had acquired Dresser Industries as CEO of Halliburton, a company with all these asbestos liabilities, and Halliburton was losing money, to now being, you know, Halliburton stock was around $20 a share then. It's around $60 now. His stock options are worth a fortune now. He says he has committed to give them to charity, and they're an irrevocable trust, but there's a lot of questions being raised about that. Why didn't he give them to charity back then, for example, you know, before he became vice president? And he's still getting deferred income from Halliburton. I mean, the conflicts of interest and the corruption in this administration, Gary, are so mind-boggling and so blatant that they make your eyes bug out.
You know, I mean, another thing that I haven't heard discussed, except by one caller of another program, was, this is an effort to break up the stevedores union. P&O wasn't able to do that. They did it in some ports, but wasn't able to get it done. And why is a bigger company, and is it going to be able to do it?
Yeah, I frankly doubt that's what's going on. I frankly just don't. I don't think that that's that big a part of their expenses. And I mean, they're making so much money on this stuff going through there. I'd be surprised if that was. That's not going to motivate a company to spend $6 billion. They may think that they can make more profit if they can bust up the union. And, you know, and they may down the road try to do that. But that's something that any corporation is going to do. They're all going to try and do that. And they're all going to get cooperation from the Bush administration in doing it, too, I'll tell you. Gary, thanks a lot for calling. And Donna in San Diego, California. Hey, Donna.
Hello.
Hello.
I want to talk to you about the veterans.
Yes.
I have a very good friend that had to have chemo.
Mm-hmm.
And he had insurance until February, and it paid for it. But then he had to go over to the VA and get it. Mm-hmm. The medicine they have is not the medicine that the outside people get. They get an old-time medicine. Mm-hmm. This chemo that he's taking now that the VA has, that they told him this, it is old, and he gets deathly ill on it. I said to him, why don't you go outside and get what you had before? Because it's $16,000 for a series, and he still makes two.
Right.
And he doesn't know whether he can get the two or not.
Yeah.
I want to know if this is what's going to happen to our veterans when they come back.
It's already here. Go to VAWatchdog.org, Larry Scott's organization, and you'll see. This Bush administration, from day one, has been cutting benefits to veterans. They have been working against the interests of veterans consistently.
And I think these veterans organizations should pick up on this, and they should let the whole United States know about it.
Yeah, I agree with you, Donna. Here's the problem. Veterans constitute only about 9% of the electorate. And the veterans organizations, because they are so, you know, like the VA and the VFW, the VFW and some of the other veterans organizations are just so wired into the idea of patriotism that the president shows up and gives a speech and pumps them up and you know, they think that that's fine. And they don't realize the disaster that's waiting them if they need to use the VA, you know, in any significant way. And, you know, there's this mix of Republicans and Democrats among the veterans administration or among the veterans groups. And so there hasn't been an organized
There never has been. In fact, except for the bonus army, I'd say after World War One, you know, during what 1930-31, where the vets from World War One went to Hoover, Herbert Hoover, and said, you know, we want the bonus, our war bonus now. During the Great Depression, I don't think that there's been an organized effort by veterans that was really across the board since then, because of the heterogeneity of the veterans, of the nature of veterans as a class of people.
Well, I was talking about not the veterans in charge.
Yeah.
I was talking about the veterans as a whole.
Yeah.
If they could get and write to their congressman about this.
Well, I hope your friend is doing that, and I would suggest there's a toll-free phone number.
I didn't know who to write to. I told him to write to the Office of Veterans Affairs, and I told him to write to his congressman and his senators, but he said it probably wouldn't do any good.
Well, he should call his member of Congress. The toll-free number, write this down, is 888-355-3588. I'll give that to you again in just a minute here, Donna. And here's the reason why you should call your member of Congress, because members of Congress are the closest to the people. They're the closest to the ground. They have smaller districts. Senators represent an entire state. Member of Congress represents a small district, and they're the ones who are the most responsive traditionally. Now, if you have a member of Congress who's not responsive, you want to work as hard as you can to get that bum out of office. But you call your member of Congress, the toll-free number, 888-355-3588. And if you don't, and if he doesn't know who his member of Congress is, all he has to do is give the operator, when he calls that number, that's the number at the Capitol Hill switchboard, 888-355-3588. Just give them his zip code, and they will say, oh, you are in Kurt Weldon's district. You are in Peter DeFazio's district, whatever, and they'll connect him with his member of Congress. Donnie, you raise an important issue, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much for the call. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, a lot of these extreme fundamentalist religions share an incomplete belief that whoever is perceived to be a non-believer is the enemy, you know, regardless of what religion it is or whatever political group it is. I mean, this is global.
Yeah. And it goes beyond religion. I mean, I think that there's a basic human instinct to say, this is my group, that's your group.
That's right. I mean, it's totally concentrated in our country because of the mixture of beliefs. And the problem is that a lot of people that hold these extreme beliefs, these beliefs aren't challenged enough,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so they just start to take on a life of its own. I mean, totally warped and twisted. And then, you know, it makes the problem even worse. So now when we're trying to address social issues or global problems like this Dubai thing, I mean, we're all kind of tongue-tied because nobody knows what to do.
Well, the Dubai issue is really just symptomatic of the larger issue, which is the corporatization of America.
That's right.
It's the doing away with democracy, the doing away with government of, by, and for we the people, the doing away with the commons. The idea that there are things that are so vital and so important, or in some cases so sacred, that we hold them collectively, and we don't want any private individual or private company or private corporation or a foreign government to own them, and so we hold them. I mean, can you imagine? We fought a war against England to get our ports. I mean, that's a lot of the battles were fought in our ports up and down the East Coast.
Yeah.
And we have British companies owning our ports. I mean, what happened? George Washington rolling over in his grave.
Totally.
I tell you, Sam Adams must be flipped out wherever he is right now. He's looking down going, holy cow! David, thanks for the call. It's strange times we live in, my friends, and that's why it's so important that we get active, that you get out there and get active. Show up for the meetings. Join Democracy for America is a great starting point, by the way. democracyforamerica.com. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Feeling so different each and every way, but I'm finding my way back home.
My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
There you go. The old Gipper haunting us today. Scotty McClellan in the form of having sold off America. Sold off. Let's just hand it over to the multinational corporations. Scotty McClellan yesterday misleadingly suggesting that 100% of containers entering the United States are screened. Let's just do a reality check here. As I pointed out, the Container Security Initiative, under the Container Security Initiative, the Customs and Border Patrol inspects 100% of all high-risk containers. Now, I'm emphasizing high-risk. He's emphasizing 100% of all high-risk containers. And they do that at foreign ports before they're loaded on the ship and headed to the United States. 100% of all cargo is screened using intelligence and using cutting-edge technology. That was all one sentence, see? So you got that 100% in there twice. Sounded like, you know, it's he says technology is very important. 100% of cargo is screened. There's a 24-hour rule in place. And, yeah. Fact of the matter is, as the Miami Herald reported on February 16th, U.S. Customs and Border Protection only screen about 5% of containerized cargo entering the country for weapons of mass destruction. It says all containers are reviewed for their threat potential, with containers with unusual manifests being singled out for scrutiny. So we'll see what's happening here with this thing. It's just, you know, on and on it goes. By the way, just to take a break from that for a moment, a final word from Jack Abramoff. Folks at Think Progress bring us this. When one of my closest and dearest friends, Jack Abramoff, this is what Tom DeLay said in the Northern Mariana Islands in 1997. He said, when one of my closest and dearest friends, Jack Abramoff, your most able representative in Washington, D.C., invited me to the islands, I wanted to see firsthand the free market success and the progress and reform you've made. This while Tom DeLay was visiting the sweatshops and the slave labor. And, I mean, the major industries in the Mariana Islands, sweatshops where they're making clothing for the U.S., and the sex trade industry. So Tom DeLay goes there and he says, when one of my closest and dearest friends, Jack. So now here's a handwritten letter. This is from Tom DeLay. Now, keep in mind, that was back in 97. This is February 6th, 06. He writes a letter to his friends in Congress. He says, a final word on Jack Abramoff. The notion that he was a close friend who wielded influence over me is absolutely untrue. Says, the reality is Jack Abramoff and I were not close personal friends. I met with him only occasionally, in fact, less frequently than numerous others who brought issues before Congress. Never did he receive preferential treatment. Hmm. Tom DeLay melting down before our eyes. Also, as they note over at Think Progress, the reality is coming into conflict with rhetoric with regard to George W. Bush and family incomes. President Bush likes to sell his tax cuts for the rich by saying, we want our families to have more money in their pocket. Right? Remember that? And, of course, you know, his original sales pitch that if we just cut taxes, you know, by $550,000 for every job created, then we'd have some jobs.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion in across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so anyhow, in August of 2004, the White House reported, and I quote, real after-tax incomes are up 11% since December 2000. Now, that number got trumpeted all over the place. All the right-wing talking machine, you know, the talk machine was out on it. I mean, it was everywhere. 11% real after-tax income. Well, the Federal Reserve just released the data. Just came out today. Federal Reserve reported today, and I quote, average income of American families. Now, remember, in just a few months ago, just about 6 months ago, the Bushies were saying, well, no, about a year and a half ago, the Bushies were saying that real after-tax incomes as a consequence of their tax policies were up 11% since the end of 2000. Now, here's what the actual Federal Reserve Board said. Quote, average income of American families after adjusting for inflation declined 2.3% in 2004 compared with 2001. And they have a chart where they show from 95 to 98, the mean income was up, looks like about 12.5%, 13%. From 98 to 2001, now we're looking at the Clinton years here, 98 to 2001, the mean income was up, looks like about 17%. And from 2001 to 2004, these 3 years of wonderful Bushonomics, the mean income was down, looks like to me about 2.5% from looking at this chart. below the zero threshold. Below the zero threshold. Declined. Well, 2.3% is actually what they said. So that's what it is. There you go. So Bushonomics, Reaganomics, they're not bombing Russia, they're bombing us. And on top of this now, the White House says that they have investigated Katrina and they have found that they didn't commit any errors, no errors at all. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with what they did. Nothing at all. By the way, it's some of the emails I've been getting on this port thing. I just wanted to, just as we're wrapping up, just wanted to share this with you. This one probably represents the vast majority of emails I've gotten that say essentially the same thing. UAE control of U.S. ports by the Bush administration, merely an example of political adaptation of the good cop, bad cop technique of manipulating public opinion. Working together as a team, the Bush administration is the bad cop, Republican politicians the good cops. The Bush administration is giving congressional Republicans an opportunity to impress their constituents. Makes sense to me. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program tomorrow, brunch with Bernie Sanders. Jeffrey Kleinman with DVD Talk is going to be with us. That and more in your calls. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.